Thank you, Your Honor. And I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Robert Borquez, registration number 19577, representing the defendant appellant, Leroy Gardenhall III. This is an appeal from district court's order denying the defendant's pro se criminal motion for post-conviction relief under Rule 35C without a hearing where the defendant alleged at least two potentially meritorious claims for relief. And there's some confusion throughout this case because both defendants have the same first and last name, and I'm going to refer to my client as Mr. Gardenhire III, his dad, who was the co-defendant, Mr. Gardenhire Jr. The first claim is that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to investigate two bystander witnesses. Their names were Tiffany Locke and Candace Miller, and these bystander witnesses allegedly could have testified that the kidnapping victims in this case, Richard Evans and Tommy Lee Emery, were not forced to get into the car, but got into the Gardenhire car voluntarily. And that's significant, Your Honors, because my client and his dad were both convicted of felony murder. They were also charged with first-degree murder. After deliberation, the jury acquitted them on that, but convicted them on second-degree murder. So, if there was no kidnapping, the felony murder was not a viable charge against them.
Counsel, Mr. Borquez, excuse me. Sure. On that point, let me ask you this. Even if there was eyewitness testimony that the two victims entered the car voluntarily, how would that affect the kidnapping charge when there's evidence that after they entered the car, at least one of them was shot by the defendant, and both of them were not released and were transported from one place to another? Would that not constitute kidnapping itself, that conduct?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. I would argue that it doesn't, because if they got into the car, I would argue that the act of the kidnapping was the allegation that Mr. Gardenhire Jr., I believe Mr. Evans testified at trial that Mr. Gardenhire Jr. hit him over the head and pushed him into the back seat of the car. And I think there was testimony from Mr. Evans that a similar act was committed. It's our position that that was the act of first-degree kidnapping. Whether keeping them in the car, is that where Your Honor is going?
Yes.
That might have been a lesser degree of kidnapping. But I think that the act of forcing him into the car is what the kidnapping charge, the first-degree kidnapping and the felony murder charge are based upon. So conceivably, there could have been a lesser kidnapping or false imprisonment offense. But I don't know if that answered your question. Okay. But following through on this issue, this very issue was raised in Mr. Gardenhire Jr.'s appeal. Mr. Gardenhire Jr. filed his own Rule 35C motion, and he had a laundry list of issues that he raised. It was quite a lengthy list. And the trial court, or the post-conviction court, denied his motion in toto. And he took an appeal, and the Court of Appeals, a different panel, upheld the denial of most of his motion, but did reverse on the one issue of whether he was entitled to a hearing on this one particular claim, whether his attorneys were ineffective in failing to interview and call Ms. Lockett or Ms. Locke and Ms. Miller to testify at trial. And that was sent back for a appointment of counsel and an investigation, and Anthony Noble was appointed to represent Mr. Gardenhire Jr. in the district court on that issue, and he's filed periodic status reports. I believe they're in the record. He has not been able to either confirm or deny that this issue has any viability. So it's still an open issue. Our argument is that if it was an open issue for the dad's case on his 35C, it's an identical issue in my client's case, and it should have been reserved as an open issue.
Didn't the district court do that? Didn't the district court reserve it as an open issue in Mr. Gardenhire III's case?
No, Your Honor, she didn't. And
I thought she said that, that when she read the report from the father's counsel, that, as you said, there had been no nothing found with regard to these witnesses, but she said that she would open the case later if something else was discovered.
She, the wording in that order, and I think I've got it here. But the wording in that order, Your Honor, that was in response to the motion for reconsideration that we filed after she denied Mr. Gardenhire the III's motion in November. I think it was November 16th, 2010. We did a motion for reconsideration. December 13th, she denied that as well. She did make the remark, and I'll read it here. While the court recognizes that it is possible for determination to be made in the case involving this defendant's father regarding these two witnesses, the court will, if necessary, reconsider that portion of its order at that time. If that's what Your Honor is referring to,
that's what I'm referring to.
I question whether a defendant could 6 or 12 months down the road move to reopen a denied Rule 35C motion. I would question whether she would have jurisdiction to do that.
I mean, the way you're talking now, is it even a final order?
Excuse me?
Is it even a final order that, we have jurisdiction over?
It says a motion for reconsideration is denied at this time. I take that as a final order.
So let me ask you a question. Let's assume that this panel agreed with you that your client ought to get essentially what the father got. What is the relief that you're asking? What's the remedy that you're asking for here? Some kind of remand, but what do we tell the trial court to do?
Basically tell the district court to hold my client's Rule 35C claims open pending a determination of, what happens in his father's case.
The case has been going on for about 6 years. Hasn't the Mr. Noble been trying to find the defendants?
Mr. Noble
the witnesses?
Mr. Noble has been working on that, Your Honor. He has not had any success yet, but at the same time, he hasn't filed a final status report telling the court that there's nothing here.
Is there any time limit? You would just keep the case open for the remainder of the natural life of the defendant?
I don't know. That's a very good question, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that. I think at some point, Mr. Noble is going to bring some kind of closure to his client's claim, my client's father's claim. I think at some point, he's got to file some kind of final status report.
Okay. Am I hearing you that you're relying on him then? You're not asking for an evidentiary hearing now on that claim?
I think that this should basically trail. Well, I do have the other claim.
No, I'm talking just about this
particular claim, Your Honor.
Right.
I think that basically this should be tagged on to what happens with the father's claim.
Presumably because you don't have the witnesses either.
Correct.
Okay. You're not asking to do an independent investigation.
No, Your Honor. That would probably be a waste of resources.
Thank you. That's helpful.
If there are no other questions on that issue, I'd just like to briefly touch on the other issue. And that has to do with the fact that at no point was there any request made for a guardian ad litem for my client. My client was 17 when he was arrested in this case and when the offenses, this case allegedly occurred. And yeah, strictly speaking, there was an adult parent in the courtroom with them, but in this case, it wasn't an adult parent acting as his father. It was an adult parent being a co-defendant. And it was really incumbent upon trial counsel, it's our position, to have requested appointment of a GAL. I realize that that was discretionary with the trial court to do, but I think given the facts in this case, the fact that my client was facing a class one felony of which he was eventually convicted, you know, it was incumbent upon the attorney to request the GAL, and the court should have granted one.
statutory support for that proposition?
Your Honor, my understanding is the statute changed around 1996. So prior to that, there was not any statutory authority. I believe I cited some case law in our brief in other cases where GALs had been appointed for juveniles in criminal cases. But as far as the statute, I believe, changed around 1996.
You're arguing, saying it was abuse of discretion, but I take it you're arguing that because this was a murder one charge, he was per se entitled to appointment of a GAL?
I think there should have been a GAL appointed given the seriousness of the charge, yes.
Not per se entitled.
There was no statutory authority, if that's where you're going with that, Your Honor, until after 1996, but I think that there was a compelling reason to.
Compelling reason being?
The seriousness of the crime and the fact that the parent was the co-defendant.
And that there should have been some adult supervision available to him?
Yes.
Why doesn't or did not his trial counsel, count as adult supervision being available to him?
That's a fair question, Your Honor, but the response I have to that is that his attorney fulfilled a role as an attorney, and that's not necessarily the same thing as a guardian ad litem. So I think that a guardian ad litem could have helped him make some decisions.
You cited Section 19.2.5.11, which is the statute that allows or requires that a parent be present in a custodial interrogation. But that is an exception if the juvenile is represented by counsel. There is no need for a parent. So doesn't that pretty much undercut your argument?
I think that in this case we're looking at, because of what he was facing as far as the seriousness of the offense, and we're talking about the entire trial, not just having a parent or guardian present during his giving a statement.
18 at the time.
By the time of trial, yes. Between the time of his arrest and the time of trial, he did reach the age of majority.
I don't recall in Mr. Gardenhire's motion that he stated that he would have done anything differently had he had a GAL appointed for him during that time. Is that correct?
I think that he made some vague references to having someone to advise him on ethical considerations, I think was the language he used. Your Honor, I would just keep in mind this was a pro se motion. And I think that you've got to give it some, read it liberally. And had he had an attorney to go through with him, what would you have done differently and would have crafted a better pleading?
And at the time of the commission of the crime, he was 17, but he turned 18 shortly thereafter, did he not?
His birthday is May 27th, 1974, Your Honor, so it was a couple of months later.
During most of the trial, he was an adult.
He was an adult by the time of trial, yes. If there are no other questions, I think I'm down to 1 minute 45 seconds.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
That's okay.
Remind you.
That's okay. I went longer than I thought. No other questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Majid Yazdi, representing the people in this case. On the question of the GAL appointment, the statute that was cited in the opening brief, 19.2.5.11, does not support the argument that the defendant was entitled to the appointment of GAL because it deals with the admission of evidence, and that is not the case here. And in addition to the fact that the defendant was almost 18 and there was no evidence that he was incapable of making decisions, so there is no ground for the position that he was entitled to any adult advisory, counsel or guardian ad litem.
Counsel, contest that the court had could have had the discretion to appoint a GAL?
I don't think, Your Honor, under any statute that would authorize the court, except, you know, the 19-2-511 statute that specifically addresses that particular situation.
So it's your position that not only was he not entitled to it, but that he...
Correct.
The court had no authority to appoint a GAL.
Correct.
Okay.
What about the case authority that Mr. Borges says that he has cited supporting that proposition, that the court does have discretion?
I'm not familiar with the case, Your Honor. Which case is it?
I don't know exactly which cases, but I know just now in oral argument, Mr. Borges said he cited cases in his brief that support the proposition that the court has had discretion to appoint GAL.
As far as I can remember, Your Honor, the argument was made based on the statutory authority, and that's what I addressed in my answer brief, and that's what I recollect from that. On the question of the 35C motion, as the court pointed out, what the defendant is asking is an open process, and it has been, I believe, more than 2 years, almost 2 years perhaps. I have here that Mr. Noble, the father's counsel, filed his last status report in January of 2011. And that report pretty much says that there's nothing that they could verify in terms of who these witnesses were, and especially defendant had claimed that they were actually dead by now, and that's why the counsel was ineffective for not investigating and finding out what the witnesses could have testified, and he couldn't even verify their death. So it seems to be completely, without any basis, and that is why it has taken so long, that Mr. Noble has not produced any report that would substantiate the claims made by the defendant. And based on that, and of course, the argument was that because the court, a division of this court, has had remanded the case in the father's case for further investigation, then the defendant in this case is entitled to that under the law of the case. And as I have argued, the law of the case does not apply to, does not entitle the defendant to any such, open 35C motion, because in that case, the remand was for the father's case, and the law of the case applies to the father's case, not to the defendant's case. So it is not based on the law of the case that the defendant would be entitled to any granting of the motion. The court should base it on its evaluation of the 35C motion. And in this case, the defendant's case, the court looked at it and concluded that there was no basis in the motion to substantiate that. And as the court noted, left that option open that if in the future there is some new evidence that is found, then in that case, maybe the court would reconsider the 35C motion.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because I want to talk about a hypothetical that I understand isn't in front of us right now, but based on what the trial court said, I mean, what happens if 6-10 years from now, these two witnesses magically show up here in Colorado and defense counsel finds out about them? I mean, at that point, what is the defendant entitled to?
I think it falls under a justifiable excuse for, not meeting the time bar for 35C, perhaps, if there is valid ground to say that they did everything and they could not find it earlier. And then that would be an exception to the limit time bar on the 35. Well,
presumably, it'd have to be more than that. Not only that would you have to find them, you have to have some evidence that they would say what the defendant says that they were going to say, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Is there any evidence in the record that, other than the allegations of and his ever existed?
As far as I can remember, Your Honor, the first time that this issue is raised is when the defendant makes this claim many years after the trial. There was no evidence. There was no reference, as far as I can remember, from the record.
Nothing in the police reports or anything like that about these two witnesses?
Again, my recollection is that no, Your Honor.
So your position that we should treat this investigation with regard to these two potential eyewitnesses as closed now and not available to the defendant, because the defendant hasn't asked for his own separate investigation. He's asking, I think, as he put it, it should be tagged onto or it should trail onto the father's investigation. Is it your position that that investigation is completed and done, and therefore there's nothing to tag onto?
Your Honor, I think the question is that if whatever happens in that case, of course, is relevant to the father's case, and the only legal ground for keeping the defendant's case open was that it is the law of the case. And if the court agrees with me that the law of the case is inapplicable here because we are talking about a different defendant, a different case, then that case has nothing to do with this. The court must base its ruling on the 35C motion based on what is alleged in the 35C motion. And because there is just a vague reference and there's no support for that, and there is, in the court can take into consideration that the other case has not resulted in any conclusive, finding, then maybe that would be part of the consideration of the court by being aware of the fact that there is an investigation going on that apparently is not going to resolve any issue.
But is there any substantive difference on this issue between what the father was alleging in his 35C and what Gardenhire 3 is alleging in his 35C?
No, Your Honor. The claims are actually...
It's the same case. I mean, there are two different motions by two different defendants, but it is the same case, correct?
It is.
I mean, they were tried together in one trial, correct?
They were jointly tried, yes, Your Honor.
So, I'm trying to understand. I mean, you seem to be saying that there wasn't anything really alleged to get this defendant from point A to point B in his 35C, but if he alleged the same thing that the father alleged in his, and we have a prior division saying, well, that's good enough to at least get an investigation, why doesn't that carry over here?
Well, because it was a different defendant in the post-conviction proceeding, and it was a different 35C motion. I understand the court's point that, yes, it is the same substantive claim, but these are two different proceedings. It is not the law of the case that governs this proceeding. It is a separate proceeding for the father. For whatever reason, the court decided that it was a division of this court remanded, thinking that there was enough reason for having a hearing on that one. But in this defendant's case, there was a different conclusion. So we are talking about two different proceedings involving two different defendants in the post-conviction phase. And I don't think the law of the case, at least, does not require the court.
Was it the same trial judge? I get confused. This case has gone on forever. Was it the same trial judge who denied this defendant's motion?
And I don't think so. As far as I remember, okay. I can't say for sure, but I don't think so.
So you're saying that defendant here, Gardenhire 3, is not entitled to the same relief that Gardenhire Jr. received because Gardenhire 3 argued law of the case.
Yes.
And his father's resolution and is not law of the case to him.
Correct.
In his case.
Yes.
But you also raise another interesting point. I don't know if it's actually before us now or not, but assuming that Gardenhire Jr., the father's investigation is concluded by his counsel with the finding that these witnesses do not exist or he can't find them. Is that binding on Gardenhire 3 when it's another, it's not his counsel that arrived at that conclusion?
Interesting question. I don't think it really makes any difference, Your Honor, because it is the defendant who did not even ask for investigation in this particular case. So the defendant is relying on that. So it is their burden to show to the court if there is reason to have further investigation. And if the other investigation does not, you know, end in any conclusive finding, then obviously what they based it on, the defendant in this case, is what something that deprives them of any relief because there is no investigation that they can produce. So it is something that they requested by the defendant requested the court to rely on that investigation. Whether it is binding or not, it is the defendant who is asking the court to use it. And last point is that in terms of not appointing substitute post-conviction counsel, it is interesting that Mr. Borquez is here representing the defendant in fact, even though the court denied the post-conviction substitution of the post-conviction counsel. Because initially, of course, Mr. Borquez was appointed to address only the issue of whether the defendant should testify in his father's post-conviction proceeding, limited to that advice. But somehow, this representation continued even today. So there is actually post-conviction counsel appointed, or the reason that the counsel was appointed somehow got extended to representation on other issues, even though that was a limited representation that the court specified in the order. Unless the court has any question, we ask the court to affirm the denial of 35C motion. Thank you.
Just very briefly, Your Honors, and I believe it's in my reply brief, there's case law in Colorado that discusses the law of the case rule, and some of the case law talks in terms of you have to have the same defendants in the same case and the same issue, and others talk about the same issue in the same case. It doesn't require identity of defendants, and I think those cases are discussed in my reply brief. So some of them require all three, and some require only two of those. The other thing I just wanted to really quickly address was my role in the post-conviction court's proceedings. I was initially appointed, I think it was in September of 2010, to simply go out and advise Mr. Gardenhire III about whether to meet with Mr. Noble, be interviewed, and be available to testify. There was, I believe, a request made by Mr. Gardenhire III to the district court asking that I be appointed to represent him in the district court on the post-conviction relief motion he filed. I believe that was denied. After the district court denied the pro se motion in November of 2010, I spoke with Bert Neslanek at ATC and asked her what should I do about this, because I know that this motion has been denied now. This guy has a right to file a notice of an appeal, and she told me to go ahead and file the notice of appeal. So that's how I really got involved in this at the very end of the case. So I don't know if there are any questions about that. I have been paid, Your Honor, yes. Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your helpful arguments. This matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.